22 segundos. Vamos a repartir el texto traducido al castellano, porque él va a hacer la exposición en inglés para que no haya ninguna dificultad para seguir. It's a pleasure now to introduce Professor Gary Calor. He's working at Penn State University. He knew Ferrer Mola very well, and he's going to talk now on Ferrer Mola and Dewey in the foundations of philosophy. Thank you very much for coming, for being here in Germany. We are pleased that you are here.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. Before I begin my paper proper, I would like to thank Secretary Cabras for this kind invitation. I would like to thank all of you here in the university for your hospitality, warmth, helpfulness, and making this very rich and rewarding experience. I would also like to thank Priscilla Cohn, my colleague emerita and good friend for many, many years of encouragement, support, commiseration for all my many intellectual, personal, and political projects. I couldn't have done it without you. Thanks so much. The debts to Ferrer of which I speak in my paper are debts I owe to her as well. Professor Cohn, Professor Ted Cabras, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and no less a privilege to stand in the midst of those I'm sitting, but to be in the midst of those who are dedicated to the task of remembering the life and furthering the thought of José Ferrer de Mora. It is moreover an honor and a privilege for which I am worthy, for my contribution to these proceedings is modest while my debt, personal and intellectual, to the man who was a revered teacher, mentor, friend, companion, is boundless. Since such a debt can never be repaid, I hope that by being here to celebrate his memory and the vitality of his ideas, it may in some small way be forgiven. 10 years ago, Professor Terry Cabras gave a lecture at Bryn Mawr College in memory of Raja Mora, in which he said something that holds fast for me to this day. Quote, "The relation each one of us has had with Ferrer de Mora is, deep down, much less important than the relation he established with us," end quote. Each of us, I think, can attest to a particular aspect of the man that made him so unique a presence in our lives. For me, it was his special genius by means of an unsurpassed learning, imagination, and sense of humor to transfigure the everyday into moments of unforgettable significance. There was nothing of the world too trivial, no ordinary artifact, no natural object, no idea, no fad of popular culture that escaped his ravenous curiosity and power to make over into something of enduring meaning. I'm speaking of his philosophical insights, of course, and his literary and cinematic possessions, but also the example of his life and spirit. To me, they exemplify the generosity in every sense of the word of the man and his sensibility. To be a philosopher, according to Ferrer, is to take nothing for granted. Yet this is, at the same time, a corollary to a temperament that discounts nothing in principle. If Ferrer taught us to respect the generous abundance of the world through his works, public and private, he left that world incalculably more abundant. Needless to say, on an occasion such as this, to continue in this vein for long would be impertinent to the point of scandal. Ferrer himself would have little patience for it, especially when there were philosophical matters afoot. Let me attend to the task at hand. The purpose of my essay is to juxtapose the foundational elements of the thought of two great 20th century North American philosophers, Ferrer de Mora and John Dewey. At first blush, the reasons against such an effort might appear to be more compelling than any would justify the attempt. In the first place, save for an elegant entry in the Dictionaria de Philosophia, Ferreter's writings have little to say about Dewey, and it is unlikely that Dewey influenced Ferreter to any vital extent, notwithstanding the latter's pragmatic and naturalistic tendencies, which, in any case, seem to have a greater affinity with those of C.S. Peirce, or even in some instances, William James. Moreover, Ferreter's linguistic turn, his concern for the philosophical problems of language and embrace of the methodology of the analytic movement in his later work, would appear to move him even further away from any point of meaningful comparison with Dewey. Indeed, what do we gain by rubbing Ferreter and Dewey together? There are two ways to answer such a question. The first is to emphasize related areas of philosophical concern and affinities between their systems. Thus, it would be impossible to deny that both are unapologetic philosophical reformers who offer brilliant schemes of philosophical reconstruction, motivated to overcome the stultifying dualisms of traditional conceptualization. In addition, Dewey and Ferrata Mora alike are committed to metaphysics of continuity. Metaphysics, moreover, framed in naturalistic terms and grounded in empirical method. Lastly, it can be argued that Dewey and Ferrata Mora alike are philosophers who make death a fundamental feature of their ontological understanding. There is a second way to answer the question as well. Assuming Ferreter and Dewey have similar, if by no means identical, projects, there is little doubt that in important ways they exhibit often radically distinct orientations. Yet this is all the more reason to rub these two philosophers together, for is it not one of Ferreter's own inspired and enduring insights that such radical disagreement in orientation, when dialectically reconstructed, leads to the most intellectually productive results? I hope, therefore, that by illuminating similarities and differences to enlarge our understanding of both philosophers and the issues so central to their common concern. The first part of my paper is Dewey and Ferrata Mora on the Point of Departure, a Thread Through Ortega. My inquiry begins with an account of beginnings, philosophical beginnings to be sure. It is prompted by a provocation by Henri Bergson, recently elaborated by the American philosopher Douglas Browning. According to the latter, Bergson insisted, quote, that at the heart of every great philosophy there pulses a simple and unique intuition of the way things are, a single point which its author attempts, ultimately unsuccessfully, to articulate and to communicate to others. End quote. Let us set aside for the moment the fact that Bergson's well-known bias, such a great and vital intuition, is inherently indescribable, if only because the philosopher's tools are concepts and conceptual structures are degenerate forms of understanding, incapable of adequately capturing what is real. Nevertheless, we must begin somewhere, and so long as we do not treat that somewhere absolutely, there is no harm in accepting Bergson's suggestion as a working hypothesis. Thus, though Bergson may exaggerate the alleged incommensurability between a coherent philosophical vision and its dialectical expression, let us allow that a philosopher has a starting point. Quote, a distinct slant which, once grasped, can serve as a key for unlocking our understanding of that vision. End quote. Browning refers to the starting point as the philosopher's bedrock. What is more, suppose we entertain that this point of departure is something really quite simple, something so basic that until we grasp it, the full significance, we might say the whole point of that philosophical vision eludes us. Moreover, while this bedrock, once it is comprehended, opens up a system to philosophical analysis, it is not easily excavated for philosophical analysis. To see the significance of this idea for a comparison of Ferreter and Dewey, it is worth consulting Browning's text. Quote, in Dewey's philosophy, the bedrock fact, the fact which we cannot go beneath or beyond, the root of all this philosophy, so to speak, is simply experience. From an external point of view, we may, of course, refer to such an item as the basic assumption of one's entire philosophy, but from within that philosophy, it is not something which the philosopher merely assumes to be true. It is not something to be captured by a proposition which the philosopher could treat as either provisional or certainly true. For Dewey, for example, anything that can be said about the bedrock is open to reconsideration, but the bedrock itself is presupposed by any such reconsideration. It is, as Ortega found himself forced to say, in what is philosophy, quote, the basic datum of the universe, end quote, and therefore, quote, philosophy's point of departure, end quote. It follows then that all philosophical investigations, whether phenomenological, speculative, theoretical, epistemological, aesthetic, metaphysical, or whatever, rests upon and depends upon that bedrock. You can't squeeze your philosophical concern for reality, for example, out of anything else, as though there is another sort of fruit, another bedrock, which can be introduced in the squeezing. Quote. After the passage is quoted, Browning makes two additional points. First, his analysis is that the starting point, the bedrock for Louis and Ortega, is identical, despite other differences between the two thinkers. The, quote, radical reality of which Ortega speaks in Man and the People, that is, quote, only the life of each person is only my life, end quote, is no less or more what Dewey means by experience and primary experience. In fact, it is Browning's contention that the shared point of departure is articulated with such startling clarity by Ortega that we gain a greater understanding of Dewey by bringing his thought into focus alongside the former. The second point he makes is that the distinction drawn between what is bedrock and the starting point is merely functional. Thus, quote, what is referred to as the starting point is nothing more than what can also be referred to as bedrock, though it is referred to under a description which specifies its initiating and grounding role in inquiry and thus serves to pick out a specific presence of that which is bedrock and serves to allow, therefore, our characterization of it as having certain role-providing features, end quote. In Experience in Nature, for example, Dewey insists that, quote, experience presents itself as the method and the only method for getting at nature, penetrating its secrets, end quote. Furthermore, he proclaims, quote, experience is a starting point and a terminal point as setting problems and testing proposed solutions, end quote. Dewey, moreover, introduces a distinction between primary and secondary experience as a methodological principle, quote, this consideration of method may suitably begin with the contrast between gross, macroscopic, crude subject matters in primary experience and the refined, derived objects of reflection. This contrast should not be taken to designate two different kinds of subject matter, but serves only to indicate that in the context of method, it is necessary to distinguish two poles that designate the same subject matter. Experience that is reorganized by reflection into the possibility of intelligent action, and experience that is not so organized. Browning further distinguishes three phases by which the starting point is discursively articulated in the two philosopher systems. The first phase of articulation involves the designation of a certain subject matter as identifying what is being referred to by the names experience and my life. The second provides a general characterization of the subject matter designated. This takes place as a distancing from the subject matter in an effort to objectify and specify it in ontological or epistemological terms. Such a characterization projects the, quote, generic traits, end quote, of what is designated. For Dewey, these traits, immediacy, interaction, temporal quality, and continuity, form the salient features of his metaphysics of experience. For Ortega, such generic traits would be the, quote, decisive attributes of my life, end quote, as he refers to them in some lessons in metaphysics. That is, immediate presence, my finding myself in the world, and being preoccupied with the things and beings of the world, and the temporality of having continually to decide what we are going to be. It must be noted, however, that while Ortega's generic characterizations appear essential and unquestionable, Dewey's are always provisional and subject to revision, a fact attributable perhaps to the former's phenomenological disposition as opposed to the latter's pragmatic one. Moreover, Dewey's characterization moves out from an analysis of experience to a metaphysics of existence by means of what might be called his, quote, ontological hypothesis. That is, quoting Dewey, suppose, however, that we start with no presuppositions save what is experienced, since it is a manifestation of nature, may, and indeed must be used as testimony for the characteristics of natural events. End quote. A third means by which the subject matter is inquired into, the bedrock, involves the provision of an explanation of it. It is in this context, which presupposes both designation and characterization, that questions of its, quote, provenance and progeny, unquote, can be answered. Here is deployed that skein of logical antecedents and consequences, in light of which a philosopher's starting point can be situated within a tradition or traditions, within a fabric of theorizing and arguing. To further elaborate the connection between Dewey and Ortega, as Browning does with subtlety and insight, would be for my purposes unnecessary. What has been said so far, however, gives us some traction for engaging the views of Dewey and Ferrater on the foundations of philosophy. Thus, we may reasonably that Ferrater's criticisms of Ortega, with whom he includes others, on the notion of a point of departure, serve as proxy criticisms for Dewey. Not only does Ferrater reject experience as radical reality in the Ortega-Dewey sense, he rejects the very idea of the starting point of radical origin. To be a philosopher for Voltaire is to take nothing for granted, and thus there can be no fixed place from which to begin. For him, there is simply no point of departure in the sense of a prior absolute reality or principle which gives rise to or is constitutive of the world, or our knowledge thereof, or to say the same thing, all other realities. Yet, I will argue that Browning's analysis of the starting point, though restricted by him to a consideration of being undertaken, can be generalized to include Voltaire's perspective on philosophical foundations. Thus, though Voltaire can seem to have a different starting point, from that of Dewey, we find in his mature work a bedrock in all phases of its articulation, designation, characterization, and explanation. In other words, if we test Bergson's hypothesis against Voltaire's text, we will find that it succeeds in making available to us what we desire, an illuminating method of interpreting the similarities and differences between Dewey and Voltaire. For Voltaire, the starting point of the bedrock cannot be other than the world, mundo, which he also designates by the terms what there is, lo que hay, or reality, la realidad, to be understood as las realidades. There is nothing startling in saying this. I am now the first to say it would be peculiar, and I believe unfruitful to think that, insofar as there is a single point of departure for Voltaire, there could be any other. In Fundamentos de Filosofia, we encounter it immediately, and Voltaire slyly introduces it in a way that establishes at once a sense of familiarity and at the same time a sense of distance. It is my host, the world, mi anfitrión del mundo. The world is my host, not something that belongs to me. It is bedrock for his philosophy in the requisite senses. One, it is something we cannot go beneath or beyond and still make sense of his thought. Two, it is that which, to borrow a phrase from the American philosopher C.I. Lewis, quote, pragmatically a priori, end quote, in the sense that while everything in the world is open for reconsideration, the world itself as bedrock is presupposed in any such reconsideration. Three, it is that upon which all ontological, epistemological, aesthetic, and moral reflection rests and depends. Thus, while Voltaire denies that lo que hay, las cosas, or el mundo, grounds inquiry as a source of suppositions and principles from which we may generate each and every proposition that can be admitted as true, nevertheless, all inquiry starts with and returns to the world. Quoting Voltaire, lo que hay es un punto de partida. I apologize in advance for my Spanish pronunciation. Lo que hay no es un punto de partida en tanto que principio o supuesto, porque los principios de las suposiciones aspiran a ser conocimientos oportunamente justificados o declarados justificables. En otros términos, partir de lo que hay, si se quiere usar esta discutible expresión, no aceptar proposicionalmente o no lo que hay y proceder en consecuencia derivando de ello ulteriores proposiciones. Lo que hay es primario, no en tanto que principio de ninguna cosa, de ningún acto o enunciado, sino pura y simplemente en cuanto que toda cosa, acto o enunciado, pertenece a lo que hay. Further, el mundo sigue sin aparecer por ninguna parte. Para llegar a él, hay que retroarse al momento en que se había empezado por nunca, nada por supuesto, y advertir que se estaba ya en medias res. Que las redes, las cosas, la realidad es donde está todo, incluyente el pensamiento. The terms by which Voltaire characterizes this bedrock lie along the continuum of description from personification in anfitrión, el mundo, through example and metaphor to a formulation of generic traits or structural features of reality. Thus, quote, the world is a dense and complex mesh of things of every type and condition. The world, it is a world that harbors stars, mountains, trees, doves. It is likewise pregnant with possibilities. My host, the world, is characterized by its generous abundance. At the furthest polarity of Voltaire's bedrock characterization lie the, quote, ontological, unquote, traits of what there is, namely confluence, presence, and intranscendence. We can discern a similar axis of development in Dewey from the subject matter to be merely designated to characterization in terms of extended description, example, and metaphor. Moreover, we see these terms employed in such a way as to evoke its immediacy and familiarity. Thus, in the second edition of Experience of Nature, he refers to, quote, crude primary experience, end quote, ordinary experience, ordinary life experience, crude everyday experience, common experience, daily experience, and experience in unsophisticated form. forms. Similarly, in the first edition of Experience in Nature, he alludes to, quote, coarse and vital experience. We find as well enumerations of the content of the subject matter. We read of, quote, the things of raw experience, end quote, and the fact that, quote, stars, rocks, trees, and creeping things are the same material of experience for both the scientific man and the man in the street, end quote. We are invited to, quote, return to the things of crude or macroscopic experience, the sun, earth, plants, and animals of common everyday life, end quote. Like Ferreter, Dewey emphasizes the richness and variety of the starting point, in the latter's case, primary experience, by drawing our attention to, quote, moral and aesthetic traits, which are simply to be found in our entailment with the world, alongside the simple presence of, quote, the phenomenon of magic, myth, politics, painting, and penitentiaries, end quote. Moving beyond designation more clearly to characterization, Dewey speaks of, quote, the gross and compulsory things of our doings, enjoyments, and sufferings, end quote, and further elaborates experience as pervasively and inextricably, quote, precarious and stable, end quote. At the furthest polarity of characterization for Dewey, we find those generic traits of experience and existence mentioned before, temporal quality, interaction, continuity, immediacy. The contrast between Ferreter and Dewey on the starting point of philosophical inquiry can be more sharply focused yet. In a passage of Experience in Nature, in which Dewey illuminates the difference between his, quote, radical or immediate empiricism, end quote, and that of the classical formulation, he states, naturally, we may choose to begin our philosophizing in a manner other than empirically. For Dewey, by doing so, however, a philosopher abandons his or her social function and the source of his or her legitimacy. As he frames it in his 1917 work, The Need for a Recovery of Philosophy, quote, philosophy recovers itself when it ceases to be a device for dealing with the problems of philosophers and becomes a method cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems. Nevertheless, according to Dewey, the import of a genuinely empirical point of departure is to reject the substitution of a dialectical development of or theory about experience for an analysis of experience as it is humanly lived. Dewey's method of empirical naturalism is, as we shall see later, the groundwork for such an analysis. It is crucial not to misunderstand Dewey's meaning in this context, when there are several ways in which such a misguided substitution can occur. Primary experience encounters things, states of affairs, res, such as cellular phones, sudden rainstorms, squirrels, gothic arches, and legal proceedings, as becoming, enduring, as what we can do and depend upon, as in Ortega's sense of puntacon, as resisting and salient in their own right. For experience as primary, there can be no question as to whether these things really exist, or whether they exist or are real in a sense different from the way in which we experience them. As bedrock, we do not give an account as to how they are able to persist or why they appear the way they do. What matters is that they obtain and prevail within our lives as they make themselves present. Moreover, our descriptions, theories, or explanations of their appearance and meaning are no less for the fact themselves experiences, though not experienced as qualitatively had or felt. As early as 1905, in a paper titled The Postulate of Immediate Empiricism, Dewey is emphatic about this point, even as he employs it as an end run around ontology in the traditional sense of the term as denoting an inquiry whose purpose it is to discriminate what really exists as opposed to what is merely apparent. And quoting Dewey, immediate empiricism postulates that things, anything, everything, in the ordinary or non-technical use of the term thing, are what they are experienced as. Hence, if one wants to describe anything truly, his task is to tell what it is experienced as being. If it is a horse that is to be described, or the equus that is to be defined, then must the horse trader, or the jockey, or the timid family man who wants a safe driver, or the zoologist or the paleontologist tell us what the horse is, which is experienced. If these accounts turn out different in some respects as well as congruous in others, this is no reason for assuming the content of one to be exclusively real and that of the others to be phenomenal. For each account of what is experienced will manifest that it is the account of the horse dealer or of the zoologist, and hence will give the conditions requisite for understanding the differences as well as the agreements of the various accounts. In each case, the nub of the question is what sort of experience is denoted or indicated. A concrete and determinate experience varying when it varies in specific real elements and agreeing where it agrees in specific real elements, so that we have a contrast not between a reality and various approximations to or phenomenal representations of reality, but a contrast between different reals of experience. And the reader is begged to bear in mind that from the standpoint when an experience or some sort of experience is referred to, something or some sort of thing is always meant. Quote. The above passage is noteworthy for several reasons. In the first place, it introduces a methodological principle, if you will, that will persist throughout his middle and late works and become thematized in Experience and Nature as a rejection of intellectualism. Intellectualism for Dewey signifies the notion that experience as intellectually refined is metaphysically and epistemologically privileged, that it is somehow more real and thus worthy of inquiry than experience as qualitatively felt. By making primary experience his philosophical starting point, Dewey embodies this principle as bedrock. Furthermore, that is the principle of anti-intellectualism, furthermore, the above passage provides us with an insight into how Dewey deploys the distinction between forced and vital experience in its descriptive meta-languages. There is for him no privileged representation of an intersubjectively experienced thing, such as a horse. The zoologist's horse is no more real than that of the veterinarian, the jockey, the student of dressage, the groomsman. Nor do scientific descriptions derived from theory correspond more truly to some reality outside experience to which the less theoretically sophisticated descriptions in lesser degrees conform. The value of any description is relative to a given context in relation to some specific determinant end in view. It is the veterinarian's objectifications, to use Ferretaire's term, that we seek when the horse is ill, but it is the jockey's physically embodied knowledge we value when we place a bet. Moreover, for Dewey, there are no ultimate contexts for interpretation and no ultimate ends in view. Every experience, primary or objectified, is perspectival, conditioned, and selective. Experience is primarily an affair of doing and undergoing. The way we act upon and react to the things of our world is no doubt influenced by a multitude of factors, including historical, cultural, and social biases. Yet we must, however, from the fact that our daily entanglements with the world are preceded by beliefs, assumptions, prejudices, or what have you, ineluctably there, in other words, that what Peirce terms, quote, an immense mass of cognition already formed, that this is where our inquiry begins. Rather, according to Dewey, our philosophizing begins in the midst of our lives, having the experiences we have, then as we must, we attempt to explain why we experienced as we did. Constructing an interpretation of the influence of history, social class, culture, and language, perhaps gender, most certainly family, and other contextual factors. In fact, we may act heretofore differently because of the way we analyze and come to terms with our prejudices and cherished assumptions, as in the case of the racist, whose experiences are transformed in the light of his acceptance of the principle of tolerance. Insofar as such objectifications enter into experience, they may give rise to experiencing things in ways that were not before possible. However, theories of why we experience things in certain ways themselves arise from within experience and become only if present to us during inquiry, in the sense, again, or take a distinction of either reparar or cantar con, constituents of the starting point. Dewey not only rejects the hegemony of concepts of life experience and the analysis of philosophical beginnings, he refuses as well to reduce such experience to a socio-cultural matrix. Thus, Dewey rejects the notion that all experience is somehow theory-laden. This latter idea is motivated by a refusal to accept the myth of the given. Experience as radical reality is said to be a fiction no less than experience as pure theory. Our point of departure was already, in some sense, theoretically constituted, which is to say that it is something from the beginning we must already understand to be theoretically constituted. In fact, in Dewey's sense, the theory of experience lies at the starting point where, in fact, it is experienced as such, if that is, it is in fact there in what we are living through when our inquiry is initiated, and not otherwise. Dewey's hostility to the idea that the bedrock is theoretically constituted at the outset could not be clearer. We cannot begin there because, in Browning's words, quote, the view that experience is theory-laden is itself a theory. It is a theory about a certain subject matter, and it is tested by return to that subject matter. The insistent problem revealed here is that what is common to begin with a theoretical picture, it is the mistake of trying to transform the starting point into a picture of the starting point. End quote. For Ottomora's remarks at the starting point or point of departure from Fundamentos de Philosophia should be read as a vigorous denial of Dewey's approach. Though the latter is not mentioned by name, there can be no doubt that he is to be included in a critique of, quote, epistemological idealism, according to which, and I'm quoting Granater, mundo in summa non designa ni un objeto contrapuesto al sujeto ni algo que contenga, por así decirlo, sujetos, es más bien una dimensión de una realidad pretendidamente más básica llamada de varias formas. Dasein, Heidegger, mi vida, mi vivir, nuestra vida, lo que quería hacer, el para sí, Sartre, y entendida primariamente como un estar normalmente, aunque no necesario, no necesario. No. Mea culpa. Ejemplificado por el estar humano. No hay, pues, mundo externo, objeto, en contraste, es en relación con un mundo interno, sujeto. El mundo no está en el sujeto, pero no está tampoco fuera de él. Sujeto, vida humana, existencia y conciencia, son al igual que el mundo, aspectos y dimensiones de una situación primaria y supuestamente más radical. End quote. The problem with the notion of radical reality, according to Ferrater, is that it is neither logically nor epistemologically. Suppose we deny that this reality, so let us call it being in the world, estar en el mundo, de modo que no quepa y pesa con nada previo a ella, is a fact. We deny that it's a fact. That is, we allege that it is not something theoretically constituted, subject to confirmation or falsification as any fact, but rather that all facts in their corresponding epistemological status appear within the horizon. To posit such a radical reality, according to Ferrater, is to erect what we might call a logically self-sealing position. That is to say that if one rejects being in the world because it is not susceptible to proof in empirical terms, then one has thereby affirmed it, since it is not and cannot be a fact, but the originating ground of all fact. However, if we allow that being in the world is a fact, then it is something theoretically constituted and subject to confirmation and falsification as is any fact. Then it is no longer that reality in which the boundaries between self and the world are dissolved, but rather something that is again part of the world, a denizen among innumerable others of lo que hay. Ferrater summarizes his position as follows. This is again from Fundamentos de Philosophia. Quote, al sostener que el estar en el mundo, el vivir humano, etc., forman parte de lo que hay, me sugiero, sin embargo, que haya que partir de lo que hay del mundo como bases a la vez epistemológicas y ontológicas. Como se vio, lo que hay o el mundo no es algo de que se parte, es simplemente aquello dentro de lo cual pueden tener lugar cualesquiera puntos de partida. Con ello se vuelve a rechazar la propia idea de punto de partida y la noción de fundamento radical de un tipo de realidad en contra. End quote. The world, according to Ferrater, is not a single fact, much less an hierarchically ordered system of facts, nor is it a principle or a ground of facts. It is at most fundamental, quote, whatever is in whatever way, merely the provision of things, cosas res, which in relation to other things, namely objectifications, languages, theories, works of art, etc., also of the world, establish facts and truths as, and become parts of the world as well. It is thus no Archimedean point, no methodologically radical platform, but something which gives rise to, or rather occasionally, multiple points of departure. El mundo is, we might say, a pre-categorical device that lets anything whatsoever into an order of intelligibility. These orders, irreducibly plural starting points, are the axes in relation to whose polar opposites the realities of the world can be epistemologically and ontologically situated. They are the dialectical play of limiting concepts which themselves referentially empty, give us a purchase on that dense weave or mesh of words. Thus is the world the starting point, is the ineluctable point of reference, the continuum of de lo que hay, for indefinitely many and never entirely determined theoretical points of departure. The realities that make up the world are that from which our concepts set out, that which they seek to understand, and that to which they return to be validated. Thus, for Ferreter, is the world bedrock. It is neither entirely plural, nor is it a complete unity. It is something there for the analysis and the salience of what there already is. This latter point, Ferreter himself acknowledges in Fundamentos de Filosofía. El problema que puede plantearse es el de cómo cabe hablar de, quote, situar, quote, ontológicamente una realidad, tipo de realidad por medio de polos y por tanto con ayuda de absolutos, que por sí mismos no existen. La respuesta es que no se parte de conceptos puros para lugar tratar de construir conceptualmente las realidades, se da por sentado que estas se hayan ya situadas y que lo único que compete hacer es dar su situación o posición en el continuo de lo que hay. If my interpretation is correct, Ferreter's point of departure is the world in the sense specified, then the contrast between his and Dewey's philosophical foundation could not be more stark or revealing. In Ferreter's perspective, experience in its myriad objectifications is but one of indefinitely many traits of the world. Thus, the world is not enveloped entirely in experience, but neither is it situated entirely outside experience. Dewey rejects the world as a starting point, I suspect, because to begin with the world is to embrace the notion that when comes to knowledge of the world, human beings are merely spectators. To know or to have knowledge, according to Dewey, is not to be co-present with a cognitively refined representation of the real, but rather to transform the present in order to render an indeterminate or problematic situation determinate. What was wrong with modern philosophy, according to Dewey, was that it was mired in what he called the epistemological predicament, the product of certain assumptions that arose as a creative response to particular socio-historical circumstances of early modern life. This predicament was expressed in a series of conceptual difficulties that had since illegitimately been elevated to the status of, quote, universal, unquote, problems and perplexities. Principal among these assumptions is the belief, a legacy of the Enlightenment's secularized theology, that experience consists in the private, self-enclosed consciousness of a subject radically distinct from the existences and processes of nature. Once this assumption is made, experience comes to be identified with purely intellectual stuff, mind or awareness or spirit, and is reduced to a species of cognition, logical thought. Knowledge thus is accepted as the primary mode of experience, and knowing is said to involve the immediate presentation or representation of an object antecedently given to a consciousness positioned outside the natural world. As a result, philosophy is reduced to epistemology, the science whose purpose becomes the search for real object in its primary problem, the possibility of attaining knowledge of reality. Of course, Ferreter does not fall into the epistemological realm, as Dewey defines it, but unlike Dewey, he is both an epistemological realist as well as a metaphysical realist. In Ferreter's case, the object known is in part something outside experience as known. It is where all realities are to be found, but in no sense absolutely determined by any conceptual artifact. That is, it is in the world. To begin with experience for Ferreter is wrong-headed because it is, in the end, the effort to render the world in the image of one of its parts. Thus, we come back to the central issue. What is the proper starting point to philosophical inquiry, experience or the world? Speaking in Dewey's voice, Browning puts it succinctly. Quote, we can't start with the world and we can't test our theories by testing them against the world. Whatever we take to indicate or to provide evidence of a real world apart from experience must be found, can only be found in experience. It must be found in a glass of barilito, the aroma of a good cigar, conversation among friends, hotel hallways, cats, thunderstorms, oak trees, and all of the brazen and unpretentious things which we encounter and live among in our day-to-day lives. End quote. Ferreter's reply to these points. Dewey seeks to construct or disclose the radical reality of primary experience. When he attempts to indicate or provide evidence for the generic traits of existence by means of the generic traits of experience, the ontological hypothesis, he invokes the success of the natural sciences, their power to transform nature and to reshape reality. Yet his starting point is not compatible with scientific epistemology. Lived experience is not something itself subject to scrutiny or inquiry in scientific terms. It is simply lived. In the end, he acknowledges himself this problem as the central problem of all inquiry. That is, how can inquiry originate standards of validation and at the same time be subject to those standards? Are not epistemological norms thus both inside and outside the experience of inquiry from which they begin? Whether this circle, which we might well call a hermeneutical circle, is virtuous or vicious will not be decided here. As to the central issue, we have no resolution, and in a sense, this is Faraday's triumph, for we have at least a dense and varied terrain to explore and clarify, made possible by a dialectic between two notions. Part two, logics of reconstruction, integrationism, and empirical naturalism. Notwithstanding striking differences between Dewey and Faraday Moreau and the proper point of departure for philosophical inquiry, their respective methods, or perhaps better said methodologies, bear a remarkable similarity. Common ground emerges from their efforts to reconstruct philosophical traditions so as effectively to nullify vicious ontological and epistemological dualisms. Their logical strategies and ends sheer off into contrary directions, to be sure, but their schemes of conceptual reorganization share the same general orientation. That is, both Dewey and Ferreter maintain that the received conceptual oppositions that haunt Western philosophical reflection, mind-body, nature, experience, object, etc., are deformities of the intellect. Moreover, such polar terms conceived traditionally as realities and as such absolutes are properly seen to be functional distinctions within a given context and not existential distinctions descriptive of nature, experience, and world. Where the two thinkers part ways concerns what they conceive to be the problematic situation created by the deformity, as well as what they take to be appropriate logical technique for its resolution. Nevertheless, Ferreter and Dewey agree that what is problematic, what is critical for philosophical reconstruction, has its origin in the same fallacy. We might, following Whitehead, call this a fallacy of misplaced concreteness, but whether we do or not, its logic is clear. It permits us to consider as ontologically or epistemologically ultimate a conceptual distinction which has force, legitimately speaking, only as a provisional means within a particular end in view for locating the realities that there are. Both our thinkers accept dualities as fruitful means of conceptual organization, while at the same time both reject their calcification forms of existence. Ferreter's strategy is familiar. He regards such dualities first and foremost as living concepts, that is to say, referentially empty terms, each of which, in the words of Descartes, quote, expresses in absolute terms an important but hyper-developed aspect of the reality that is to be described, end quote. Both polar opposites are equally necessary for an understanding of the realities which lie along the axis of which they are situated and connected. Neither is sufficient. For this reason, in Being and Death, Ferreter refers to his integrationist method as, quote, the principle of complementarity, end quote. Moreover, these dualities woven into the lexicon of philosophical doctrines are in constant tension, monism, pluralism, idealism, realism, objectivism, relativism, etc., quote, are never to be resolved into a third term, which would absorb and, as it were, pacify the contrasting poles. Each of these has a role to play. It is up to the philosopher to explore the possibilities which each has to offer. It's Ferreter from Being and Death, the English edition. Ferreter's is a dialectic of productive oppositions whose resolutions never take place so as to submerge the identity of one polarity in the other. It is not, as he puts it, quote, a combinatorial philosophical system, end quote. Ultimately, for Ferreter, what is problematic, what is perplexing, what gives rise to philosophical inquiry, as we have seen, is the world, whose realities seem to us out of joint with a multitude of schemes by means of which they are described. What is solved, however, and only provisionally at that, is the conceptual location or situation of some reality or type of reality in the world. What is temporarily resolved, in other words, is some aspect of the world's intelligibility as against the perplexity of the inherited and continuing deformities of philosophical thought. In Being and Death, Ferreter describes integrationism as a form of ontology, but by fundamentis de philosophia, it has become a methodological convenience. Quoting Ferreter, lo que ha llamado ontología viene a ser, pues, en última instancia, una epistemología, o como algunos preferirían decir, ahora que la llamada empresa epistemológica está sufriendo con ciertos ataques, una hermenéutica donde el objeto es lo que ha, end quote. Thus, Ferreter's dialectic is deployed first and foremost as a means to dissolve the calcified economies of imperative dualisms for the sake of enriching the knowledge of experience. This formulation will sound peculiar, perhaps, as a description of integrationism, but my object is a comparison between Dewey and Ferreter, and I trust it will be illuminating. Philosophical perplexity for Ferreter arises because the world is problematic, primarily from the point of view of knowing. So Such perplexity is genuinely felt is the reason we philosophize by means of the method. It is not an artifice of methodology. Thus, Ferretaire accepts mutatis mutandis, Dewey's distinction between primary experience and reflected experience, that is, knowledge experience. In Fundamentus de Philosophia, for example, he states, mi vinculación junto al mundo, con lo que de él pueda quedar sin mí, pues soy sin mí, son parte de él, no se limita a actos de percepción, de inferencia general, de conocimiento. Estoy a sí mismo en el mundo en tanto que me preocupo por él, o por ciertas porciones o aspectos del mismo, o me tiene sin cuidado, o me comprometo a aceptar algunos de sus rasgos, o me dispongo a rechazarlos. Estar en realidad es también, algunos opinan, que sobre todo, tratar con ella. Significantly for Ferretaire, what enriches our spirit knowledge enriches the world for knowing and its objectifications. Indeed, all experience is part of the world growing in abundance through our dealings with it. For Dewey, as we have seen, the world where nature is problematic, but in a philosophically primary sense from the point of view of everyday gross experience, Dewey's method of empirical naturalism is designed to explode inherited dualisms for the sake of enriching experience as it is humanly lived. True to his post-Darwinian naturalism, Dewey takes the subject, object, or organism environment unity as a primary fact for philosophical analysis. As he explains in the experience of nature, quote, now empirical method is the only method which can do justice to this inclusive integrated experience. It alone takes this integrated unity as the starting point for philosophical thought. Other methods begin with results of the reflection that is already torn into the subject matter experienced and the operations and states of experiencing. The problem is then to get together again what has been sundered, which is if the kinsmen started out with fragments of the end and tried to construct the whole legality. For empirical method, the problem is nothing solved as a solution. Its problem is to know how and why the whole is distinguished into subject and object nature and mental operations. Having done this, it is in a position to see to what effect the distinction is made, how the distinguished factors function in the further control and enrichment of the subject matters of proof of total experience. Dewey, like Ferretaire, rejects the idea that there is anything like a pure subject and pure object, or pure subjectivity is a pure objectivity. Neither is there absolute unity or plurality, or any means which is not itself in some other context, an end or end which is not in some sense available as a means, etc. Moreover, our inferential and dialectical objectifications amount to tools for the resolution of problematic situations encountered in the primary experience. As Dewey's modus operandi, his pragmatic instrumentalism, if you will, reminds one of what Ferretaire rejects as combinatory metaphysics, or a doctrine in which the polar terms become tertium quid. This, however, would be a misleading characterization. It is true that Dewey, in a sense, combines the oppositions, but only after they have been reformulated as functional terms in the analysis of the problematic situation. In this sense, polarities can be epistemologically resolved rather than indefinitely, and thereby, according to Ferretaire, productively pursued. Yet importantly, this resolution is always temporary, even ad hoc. Inquiry is ever actuated by the problems of concrete experience. As perplexities change, so does the need for novel applications of conceptual dualities. The contexts which modify and are modified by reflection are inexhaustible. Dewey's dialectic is as open and interminable as that of Ferretaire. What is unproblematic for Dewey is the total situation harboring the dualities as elements of felt experience. What is problematic is its separation into rigid dichotomies, where such a separation leads to the impoverishment of such experience. Particular use of conceptual oppositions is to be justified ultimately on the basis of its effect on the qualities and textures of everyday life, that is to say, in a particular problematic context where equilibrium between the subject and the world has been interrupted and needs to be restored. Do we believe that deformed experience was a possibility for any unreconstructed conceptual opposition that had experiential consequences? And he was particularly concerned with those most immediate to his in our own time. Thus, he considered reformation of such dichotomies as work, labor, art, industry, individual society, consumer producer to be of compelling urgency. Empirical naturalism is, in the final analysis, the logic that pursues the resolution of polarities by means of extracting from each polar element what is efficacious in the transformation of an actual, that is, felt, indeterminate situation to one that is permanent. A metaphysical dichotomy of particular significance for Dewey is that between permanence and change, or sometimes flux, which he reconstructs as the distinction in experience between what is stable as opposed to what is precarious. Predictability and contingency are the indestructible features of any and all experience. But it is fitting, he says, that just this predicament of the inextricable mixture of stability and uncertainty gives rise to philosophy and then is reflected in all of its recurrent problems and issues. Dewey insists that Western philosophy, above all in terms of the great history of Santayana, the genteel tradition, reflects an elaborate strategy for denying the reality of the contingent, the precarious. Let me just go on in the interests of time to the next page. Dewey's method would dissolve the dualism between permanence and flux and be constructed upon the basis of a functional distinction between structure and process. Thus, structure denotes not a framework of ideal forms, but only those elements in a total situation that limit change. The structure of a house is the complex order or interplay of materials and forces which counteract others, namely what architects and engineers call tensile and compressive forces that, when impeded, would cause the house to collapse. A structure is what shapes change into predictable, regular, or rhythmic patterns of temporal variation. Process, on the other hand, refers to species of change that are rapid, irregular, unpredictable, and thus precarious. What Dewey does is to transform an opposition between the fixed, being, and the random, becoming, into a distinction between two temporal dynamics. This is the most salient characteristic of Dewey's logic, meant to overcome what he terms the philosophic fallacy, the replacement of all terms that specify the antecedently real by terms that specify aspects of eventual function. In the final analysis, Dewey's method is a logic of temporalization, a pragmatic hermeneutics whose outcome is the metaphysical declaration, quote, every existence is an event, end quote. It is an outlook at the center of which is the familiar notion of death as a pervasive feature of the world. The stateless thing, he says, we can speak of is not free from conditions set to it by other things, that even the solid earth mountains, the emblems of constancy, appear and disappear like the clouds as an old theme of moralists and poets. The fixed and unchanged being of the Democritean Adam is now reported by inquirers to possess some of the traits of his non-being and to embody a temporary equilibrium in the economy of nature's compromises and adjustments. A thing may endure secula seculorum and yet not be everlasting. It will crumble before the gnawing tooth of time as it exceeds a certain measure. This condition, nothing to celebrate or despair, is something for a philosopher to work with, to be noted and used. To deny the ontological parity of the precarious with the stable is to re-enter the intellectual nightmares from which Dewey and Ferrater both would awaken us. Ferrater himself affirms this parity in the formulation of his Erasmus Estructurales de lo que hay. What there is exhibits the potential for representation or presence, insufficiency, contingency, and is inexhaustible. Contains being and death, being and meaning. This paper has been devoted to an examination of the methodological framework of Dewey's and Ferrater-Morris ontologies. To pursue a detailed study of their respective metaphysical concepts and principles is an inquiry for another day. The first part of this essay ended on a note of philosophical discord between the two. The second part, it appears, has concluded on a more harmonious note. There is, I believe, a sense in which both thinkers speak in the same voice, a voice given expression in a poem by the American poet John Witt, entitled Simply Home. Returning to Earth after his life of weightlessness, the astronaut cannot lift the small bouquet of flowers the child gives him. He cannot raise his head off the pillow, pulled down by the gravity of a dream. He remembers nothing, no sound, in the absolute zero of deep space, the wild pounding of his baffled heart. He lifted a building with one hand and a pencil in the other. This is what he wanted, the world like a worn stone cast into the water. He wanted to break the promise of the body to the earth, to stop the long descent of everyone he loved under the ground. He wanted to rise, an angel in a paradise of exact data. He spills his milk on his shirt, the earth has darkness and the light, the earth has birds bickering over the last seeds, his fork slips clattering on the plate, the road is shining. Magnolia is shameless in the rain. Do not Dewey and Ferrater alike warn us against the totalitarian potential of absolutes, of paradises, of utopias wrung from the ideas cast in the sinness of pure reason? Setting aside the terrifying political consequences of dreaming as the poems an astronaut would, a pretend angel attempting to transcend the world and defy its contingency and mortality by means of sheer technique, do they not tell us that such a passion is useless? Let us practice philosophy with our feet upon the ground, as they were just to do, and test our conceptions against the things of this world, shameless in the rain. Thank you very much.